In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman. Today, we're going to have a little special guest. Pat Watson is with us today. And he's written a book. And I want to talk a little bit about the book and how it relates to EMS and first responders. And the book title is Tactical Lockpicking, A Systemized Approach for Responding to Locked Obstacles During Emergencies. And I kind of saw this book and it kind of caught my eye, and I started thinking about all the different situations that I've been in during my EMS career where I had a forced entry into a home to get to a patient, things like that. So I wanted to have Pat on and kind of talk about that a little bit. Guys, if you are listening to this on iTunes or on the blog, please go ahead and share this, like it. Leave a review or rating on iTunes. It's easy to do. You can just go to emsseo.com/iTunes and it'll take you right to the show page, and you can do that there. So I want to talk a little bit about Pat. Pat's waiting in the wings for us. He's at uncensoredtactical.com to get all his information. But pretty much, Pat's an author. He's a podcaster as well. Also does some tactical skills training. During his 11 years of service in U.S. Coast Guard, Pat actually participated in overseas operations for counter-narcotics and anti-piracy. In addition to his overseas missions, he's also served as a local law enforcement officer as well. And during operations, Pat started actually designing his personal tactical skills curriculum, and now he's on a mission to teach others his tactical skills, minus all the red tape. And you know me at emsseo.com, I despise the red tape, and that's why I started that website to begin with. So on his blog, like I mentioned, Uncensored Tactical, you can learn more at uncensoredtactical.com or on his podcast, Uncensored Tactical. Nice and easy, guys. Just remember Uncensored Tactical, and I think you will be able to find him. So, Pat, you're still with me, I hope.
I'm here.
All right, great. So Pat, I gave a little intro to you, pretty much a standard kind of short form bio. I don't know, maybe you want to add a little bit and maybe give some more insight into what you're about and what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. I can do a little more intro for you. So I spent over a decade working for the government in all sorts of different security capacities. This probably all started when I was a kid. My dad was a 30-year cop. So I knew growing up, I had these little gems of information coming in that security isn't what it seems. Mm. So I saw the old credit card in the door trick, you know, when I was just a young kid. And I saw the, dad always had a Slim Jim in the trunk. So when we saw a stranded motorist, you know, dad would get out, grab the Slim Jim, pop the person's door lock, and have a nice day. So I knew these things existed when I was just a kid. And I guess for some reason my weird patterned brain, when I was in the military and in law enforcement, I kept seeing case study after case study of all sorts of, you know, particularly the gaps in security preparedness and security effectiveness. And, you know, one of our biggest missions in all sorts of first responder jobs is get to the problem.
Yeah.
And every single day, you're often locked out of the problem. And it's just, it was so weird to me that there is almost no training for getting through locked obstacles. There is some, especially when you talk about, you know, fire and probably sometimes EMS and some other types of jobs, but I know fire does a really good job of forced entry training.
Right.
But in law enforcement and the military, it's really rare to have someone teach you how to get through the simplest of obstacles. So I designed my own curriculum from scratch, and probably my 3 years as a local police officer is where most of this was really, I mean, I was cutting my teeth with this curriculum, and it was all based on what works in the field and what doesn't. And it's very, very flexible to the individual. So I kind of start with a baseline and I give some recommendations and I talk about some patterns that you can recognize. And I teach courses and I wrote the book and I have a podcast that mostly focuses on getting through locked obstacles and being able to help people.
It's cool because I watched the video you have on your website shown the different type of locks to get into and some of the different tools that you use to do that. And I was thinking, and you had mentioned about the fire side of it, and I know a lot of listeners are also, they're paramedic firefighters, and they do very, like you said, very good job on the forced entry part of it. But then you start thinking about the property damage that goes along with that, you know, when they have to do a forced entry versus maybe if they can simply pick a lock and get past that barrier that way, you know, the issue that comes along, again, not causing property damage in the process, being able to do it that way. Now, of course, I'm sure there are situations where they feel that forced entry is going to be quicker. Mm-hmm. But looking at your website and some of the stuff that I've seen, it looks like it maybe is just as fast to do the lock picking end of it.
I just had that argument, I think 2 days ago on Instagram, something about there's nothing faster than this type of big kinetic energetic entry.
Right.
But that's provably false. One problem is the definition of terms. The term lock picking, a lot of people think of what you might see in a video game or in a spy movie where you put these tools in and you're really delicate. You have to pick each pin perfectly with perfect, you know, finesse. And that's not necessarily the case. So the term, when I say lock picking, it's a very broad spectrum of, sure, that part of it, picking each pin, and often bypasses and overrides and hacking and, you know, slipping makeshift tools through. And then sometimes it's just as simple. My approach is that I teach is it's sometimes just as simple to, you know, reach over or around or under a gate and pull the far side of the handle and you're in. So yes, sometimes kinetic entries are an effective method of entry, or you can take a very small tool that's very inexpensive and very lightweight that doesn't change your life. You know, doesn't upset your status quo of your life to carry it in your wallet or your pocket. And you take that out and you're in faster than using a breaching ram and a pry bar or a Halligan. So yes, sometimes it is faster to use a less destructive technique.
Yeah. And it's funny. I was, or before the show, it was racking my brain because I remember seeing, I wanted to ask you if it was possible. Yeah. I remember this TV show, and some Netflix series I was watching, and like every episode, they're picking locks like it's going out of style.
I know NCIS, they do that almost.
They're right into the house in like 2 seconds. I'm like, how are they getting in so fast? They pull out whatever out of their jacket, and then they're right into the home. And I'm like, what is going on that they're doing it so quick? Is that even possible to be able to get through locks that easily, you know? And I was trying to think of the show. I couldn't think of the life for me. But, you know, I guess I'm wondering
Dexter, they do that a lot. NCIS, they do that a lot. Yeah. A lot of crime scene shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to say it was some kind of like a Homeland show or something like
probably,
that.
Probably, yeah.
They were doing it. I'm wondering, the question I guess I want to ask is do the modern day like locks and stuff, can you still apply what you're teaching to the more advanced locking systems?
Yeah, so I got two questions I pulled from what you said. So one question is, so the stuff they do on TV, can we do that? Yes, I can have a child come into my course, and in a few hours, he can do most of those things you see on TV. Okay. So that's one answer. The other answer is sometimes no. There's a lot of entries that you'll see on TV where they take a screwdriver out and they put it in the keyway and they twist it. And, oh my God, it's open. Well, that's not real. So the answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. The other one, I just drew a blank. I'm so sorry. You ended that long question.
I was talking about just like modern day locks.
Yeah, okay, modern locks. Sure. I don't specialize in doing things like writing with code or switching wires around or dealing with electronics. Okay. That is not my realm. I do have some good close friends that they love that stuff. They live in it. But on a lot of very modern locks that have, you know, electronic keypads and electronic push buttons and wires and magnets, all those things still fit within my curriculum because almost all of those have physical hardware attached that we can still attack, and very simply often as well. I'll give you one from one of my personal case studies that didn't make it into the book. I took one professional training course, and part of that was working on special entries. So it was to gain access into a place where you weren't legally prohibited from, but you didn't necessarily have access to. So I was in an urban setting. I think I was in downtown Orlando at the time, walking around all the buildings. And I go into a kind of basement level parking garage that you could walk into off the street. So I'm down there, I'm looking at all the cars, and I'm like, oh, these are expensive cars. Turns out I was in some sort of hospital, high-rise, or medical building. And there's a very big, very heavy metal commercial security strength door that leads into a basement elevator room. And it has a big glass window that's like hurricane-proof. So it would have been really, really tough to do some type of forced entry in there. And I'm looking at the locks on the keyway, and I'm like, oh, I can tell easily those are commercial locks. It would be very difficult to pick. Sometimes it's doable if you have the right tools, but it's not something I want to waste my time with, which is another part of my curriculum, learning the levels of your skill set and where not to waste time. So I'm looking at this big, heavy door in this big, secure facility, and I'm like, man, how am I going to get in here? And I go to take a step away, and I'm like, probably not getting in. No way. Not going to happen. And I take a step to my right, and I see the handicap automatic open button. And I'm like, huh, that's odd. And when your brain tells you that, that's usually like, that's the universe talking to you. Like, hey, pay attention. So I go, huh, that's odd. And I look back at the door and I look back at the handicap, you know, the big silver circle that, you know, you press right into the wall and it opens for the wheelchair access. And I go, no, that's no way is that going to work. And I'm like, well, screw it. Let's give it a shot. And I bang that little button with my palm. And psh, the door opens wide open for me automatically. Oh, and there's like a key card reader and a secure keyway. And it was seriously locked, seriously heavy duty. So sometimes, you know, the full scale approach and understanding patterns that will help you get in the door even without tools. So yeah, even sometimes high security and modern locks can be bypassed with my curriculum.
Very interesting. And this works for, I mentioned, you know, you mentioned vehicles before. Is vehicles also something that you show or?
Yes, absolutely. And I actually have attended several expensive and professional entry training courses. And some of them were for military and law enforcement. And we never put our real hands on a real door or a real vehicle during the course. And I thought, this is just crazy. You're like one slide in the PowerPoint for one of those trainings was, oh, you can enter a vehicle this way. Okay, next slide. And I'm like, wait a second. There's like 30 of us in here. We can see our cars outside the window. Can we go try that? Like that was just so weird to me. So in my course, every single time without fail, we pop open real life doors. Sometimes we'll take them off the hinges if we can. We'll bypass the latch, the keyway. I'll take out the doorknob and put a different doorknob in for people to try. And then I give students a chance to open up their own vehicles that they bring with them or my vehicle that I supply. And we use multiple different methods and multiple tools to attack, yes, vehicles, doors, chains, padlocks, everything.
Very interesting. Now I know like for the EMS guys and girls that are listening to the show that probably my bigger end of the audience, you know, they think, oh, well, we don't really do forced entry. We don't really, you know, gain access. But I've been in EMS for, you know, close to 30 years, and there's been a handful of times where I couldn't wait for fire to get through.
Yeah.
To get there, and we had to get in and, you know, end up kicking down a door or trying to climb through a window and stuff. And so it can benefit having this knowledge. You know, I was watching the video, and I saw you do one thing with a screwdriver to get to the other side of the other side of the lock, just to kind of get the handle from the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, and then a door opened like right up, and I was like, I'm wondering like how many people actually think of that when they look at a door. Oh my God, it's locked. They don't think they can stick something through the small space that the hand can't get through and then hit the latch on the inside and just open it up. It's sort of like the getting on calls where the person's trapped in the vehicle and they're cutting the door open, but you go to the other side of the car.
Yeah.
And it's locked. It's that type of thing, you know?
Yeah, it's unlocked. Yeah. I have that same case study I put in the book, I think at least once or twice, where as a local law enforcement officer, and of course everyone knows that EMS and fire and police, we all work together on a lot of calls. It's happened to me from people in the medical field, people in fire, and people in police too, like some of my former coworkers. Once they had someone on their squad that they knew could get through locked obstacles, you know, with special tools and special training, they sometimes became blinded to the fact that they had options that they didn't know about either. If they would just try, they might have succeeded. So one of them that I did put in the book was, and it's common, it's happened more than once, where a professional who's intelligent and critical thinking, you know, has been around the block, they'll drive up to a vehicle gate and it'll be chain link locked in the middle with like a, you know, heavy duty chain. There's a padlock hanging on it. And they drive up to the gate and they go, oh, we got to get in for this call. We got to go help somebody or arrest somebody or whatever. Oh, we're locked out. So call Pat. So 20, 30 minutes later, I drive onto the scene and I go, all right, I'm here to help you. What do you got? Can you show me the obstacle? He goes, oh, it's over there. It's that vehicle gate. It's chained and padlocked shut. So I walk up and I look at the padlock. The padlock's already unlocked. So it's just something that some of the stuff that I say is kind of ad nauseum. So in my courses, I repeat some things over and over so that people get sick of it, but it's for a reason. So one of the very first steps, the first physical step on scene and fire and EMS, you guys should know this too, try before you pry.
Right.
I say the same thing. Step one is a manual unlock check of windows, doors, vehicles, everything. And it's actually twofold. One, you check it, then you take a deep breath and you check again harder, because that happens too sometimes, where some doorknobs or handles will have some jiggle or some play to them, or they'll be rusty or sticky.
Right.
So you try it, like, and you don't just shake it and go through the motion. You try it and then you breathe and you go, let's try again to double check. And I have several successful case studies with getting people in on scene when I'm not even there and I'm just coaching them through it through the phone. Mm-hmm. In my own case studies too, where I go, oh, it's locked. You know what? Step one, try, breathe, try again harder. And then, oh, look, it popped open. So yeah, it's a, you see the world differently once you take one of my courses or, you know, get my content. I thoroughly enjoy it. I have a passion for it, and I'll probably teach this stuff till the day I die.
And I think that's important, you know, to have the passion, the drive to show people this stuff, to kind of give them the benefits of it. That it's, like you said, it's not just a, you know, something you see on these spy movies, that there's, you know, a lot of different uses and benefits from knowing how to do this type of thing, you know? So I want to kind of go over a little bit, just some of the preparedness stuff that you cover as well, but sort of, I forget how it was worded, mm-hmm. talking about, you know, a quick way to have, I guess, a plan. And I wanted to see maybe what your thoughts are on that and maybe how some of the listeners might be able to take that information as well to, you know, apply it to their, you know, their life and what, and them themselves being prepared.
Yeah. Specifically, are you talking about my approach to the obstacles or what kind of preparedness do you mean?
Like preparedness, I'm trying to find the verbiage on it here so I can kind of say it. Right out loud so we know what the hell I'm talking about here.
No problem.
So let me get the pull up the official deal. Yeah, trying to see that. Stand by a second. Yeah, when talking about where is the thing now? Trying to read, my eyesight is, I'm going blind on top of everything else.
Yeah, you and me both.
Of course, no, I can't find it. Talked about just the preparedness, like how to get your own system, your own, I guess maybe a go bag or something like that.
I'll just take all that in general and I'll give you what I got off the top of my head.
Yeah, that'll work. Because I can't find, if I find it, no, while you're talking, yeah, then I'll clarify. Of course.
So let's talk about getting prepared with the right tools. That's a pretty unique one that I really like teaching about. Almost anybody that brings tools to an obstacle for their work or for their passion or their hobby, if you're at all mobile and you're bringing tools to a scene, most people, whether they're forced to by like curriculum or policy, or if it's just something they do a lot, they end up creating a system of how am I going to deploy these tools into the field. So I know for EMS, I was a team medic when I was in the military, so I'm able to speak a little bit of this language, but I'm a little rusty. I know that you have sometimes like an EMS bag. I know for deployment, we had our EMT kit, which was a big ass backpack. And when you unzip the whole big thing, you have your little airway pouch, your little breathing pouch, your little, dressings. Mm-hmm. So that is a really effective way to deploy your tools into the field. My curriculum is for people to add a small amount of tools, to use a small amount of money, to spend a small amount of time and energy training to get you through a large amount of openable locks. So that framing is really important. So the framing is not, hey, come check out Pat. He's going to show you every single tool that exists. You're going to buy a huge backpack. You're going to have to put a locker in your trunk or your vehicle. No, that doesn't work. That's not what this is for. So the way that I teach people to be prepared with the right tools is first, second, and third line gear. And I break it down roughly like this. First line gear is the stuff that when you walk out of your house, you know, without any bags or backpacks or boxes, if you just walk out your front door for the day, what do you have on you? Usually that's just what you have in your pockets and maybe on your belt, like a wallet, a keychain, like a pocket knife. That's your first line carry. I have a lot of tools that I put into my wallet that don't cost a lot. They don't weigh a lot. They don't take up a lot of space, and they don't negatively change the way I live my life. They don't get in the way. They don't make life worse. That's my first line gear. And with that, I can open up thousands and thousands and thousands of obstacles in the snap of a finger. Mm. And a lot of people don't understand that huge return on investment. It's not just professional. It's not just personal. It's not even just preparedness. There's a lot of skill sets that I teach people, and I'll get a phone call the next day after a course, and they'll say, hey, I was at work and I left my key to my locker in my car, and it was faster to use the tool that you gave me for my wallet than to go back and get my key from my car. So that first line gear is something that you'll know you always have with you, and it doesn't take up a lot of space and it doesn't negatively change your life. So your second line gear would be a small grab bag. And especially, this is really big for the EMS guys and paramedics and fire and police. Again, I don't want you to have a huge bag, a huge duffel bag, a huge backpack, or a whole car full of tools. So I need a small bag that you can throw into the back of your rescue truck, so that if there's an obstacle that your first line gear doesn't carry, and if you're waiting for fire to bring the Halligan or the axe, or if you're waiting for police to kick the door down, hey, you know what? My wallet is not going to cut it, my wallet tools, but we have that small grab bag that I keep, you know, with next to my lunchbox in the rescue truck. Can you go grab that for me and bring it back? That's your second line gear. That's tools that are a little bit bigger, tools that are a little bit more, you can use that, you know, those fine motor skills with the tools that have a larger handle or a different shape. And then your third line gear is your big heavy stuff, like your irons, your axes, your Hooley tool, your Halligans, Hooleys, all that, pry bars, sledgehammers, vehicle reach tools. And then there's a system for carrying those two. And to hammer home again, it doesn't matter whether you're a professional or you're just a prepared civilian. My skill set applies to both people the same exact way because of its framing. And I spent a lot of time making sure that framing made sense. So hopefully that helps with getting prepared for at least on the tool side.
Yeah, yeah. That actually, while you were talking, I actually found the bullet point.
And okay.
You hit what I was looking at. It was the tools you need and how to organize your gear for field deployment. So, yeah, you hit that pretty good there. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of cover that because I think that's where the people will struggle with this type of skill, right? Is all right, where am I? Because I remember, you know, back in the day, and the emergency services units in New York City, they would carry like a whole kind of fold out lock picking mm-hmm. kit to get into vehicles, you know. And I think people think of that type of thing, like, where am I putting that? You know, where am I putting that big yeah. fold out, mm-hmm. You know, vinyl or, you know, material type, you know, pouch, versus, like you said, keeping something that's in your wallet and then maybe something small that sits in the vehicle someplace that's not taking up a whole lot of space, but can do the job type thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where people, I think, need to kind of realize that it doesn't have to be an entire toolbox of, you know, gear and equipment and things to gain entry to places that you locked out of. It can be something very easy. And like you mentioned, that one person who said that it was easier to just use what he had in his wallet than going back and getting the keys. Mm-hmm. One thing I do want to just touch on is that I know there's a lot of the word tactical is thrown around a lot in with the book and the, you know, the websites and stuff like that. Yeah. And I'm wondering what is tactical lock picking considered?
Sure. Let's do that. Cause that's really important. And that certainly over the last decade, you know, post 9/11, that term has become a, just a free for all. Everyone's using that word, with no regard to what it means. So tactical lock picking, like we covered in the beginning, it's a systemized approach for responding to locked obstacles during emergencies. And our specific goal is to use lock picking, bypasses, and other similar methods to gain entry into, out of, or through the most common and the most likely locked obstacles. And our goal is to use all these things with a systemized approach, right? Not just, I have the tool, there's a lock, let's pair the two together. It's a systemized approach of the most efficient and effective entry that we can, with multiple options for tools and multiple options for entry points. That's where the word tactic comes in. You can say it like in conversation, like have a tactful conversation with someone. So choose the right option for it. Tactic doesn't mean you're going to bring your lock picks to a SWAT call out, and when the snipers are getting ready to shoot right over your head into the bad guy, you take out your lock picks. No, that's not, why I chose the word tactical. It's tactical because the type of entry that you choose and the type of tools that you decide to carry into the field and the type of system that you approach a lock with, you're choosing a specific tactic, and that tactic will have consequences for how your operation goes. And that doesn't mean consequences life or death, although sometimes it does. It might just be consequences like time. And I'll give you a really good example for choosing a tactic here would be, you're locked behind a big, heavy wrought iron vehicle gate that is chained and padlocked in the middle, and the padlock is actually locked, and you checked twice. So now let's say your cell phone's dead, your car's about to run out of gas, it's late at night, and you're in a rural area, right? So that's the scene. We're setting the scene. A tactic you could choose could be, well, I have my wallet, I'm going to jump over the gate, I'm going to walk a mile or two or 10 and see if I can find a hardware store or a Walmart that's open 24/7. I'm going to buy a pair of bolt cutters, I'm going to hoof it all the way back to the car, and I'm going to cut that chain. Mm. Or with some basic understanding of some of the principles that I teach, one of the tools that I give students to take with them for the rest of their life is not even a physical tool, but it's one of my favorite that I give them, which is, I call it the +1 method. A lot of other people in the hacker community will call it a brute force attack. I don't use that term because you're not applying physical force to a lock. So it's brute force by way of numbers. So trying every possible combination entry. So now we're back in a scenario. And if we're stuck with a chain linked gate with a chain and a padlock on it, if that padlock has a four digit combo setup, if you don't have a tool to pick that lock, and if you don't have a tool to cut that chain, you now have one option, which is walk by yourself late at night to a hardware store and then come back with bolt cutters, which might take 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, or 2 or 3 hours. How long would it take you to try every single combination on a four digit combination lock? Well, if you go 0001, 0002, well, you can do some simple math and you don't need to be a genius to do it. You can do it, you know, pen and paper, and you can round off. So let's say we can try 60 combinations in 60 seconds. Well, heck, let's just round up. We can try roughly 100 in a minute. Okay, so how long does it take us to get to 1,000? Well, 1 minute times 10. Okay, so that's 10 minutes to try 1,000 combos. Well, how many possible combos are there? Well, there's 10,000. Okay, so take that times 10. What's faster now? Taking maybe an hour, and because you don't know what that combination is, you might get it, you know, it might be 1XXX, so a 1,000 digit number, or it might be 5XXX, right? So 5 and then 3 other numbers. It's in the 5,000 range. Those are much faster than going all the way to 9999 on the padlock. So we have all these things now, all these different tactics, all these different inputs, multiple options to enter through that or exit through that obstacle. So we're choosing tactics based on sometimes time. So my students leave the course knowing, okay, I have a written out, printed up sheet that's saved in my phone as a PDF. I have a paper version. I've seen it. I know that if it's a three-digit lock, it's going to be less than 15 minutes for me to try every single combo. I know if it's a four-digit lock, and if I'm trying really quick, like I can get the digits moving quick and then try a pull on the lock quick, maybe roughly 2 hours or less if the combination is a low-digit number. So now you can say, well, I'll sit in my car and just sleep for the night and they'll come unlock me at 8 o'clock in the morning when the staff arrives. Or it will take me less than 2 hours to try every combo. Let's just get started. So choosing tactics for how you enter is important. And it doesn't mean tactics like shooting and fighting. It means tactics like having a tactful approach.
It's funny you say that. I have a program that I teach on taking exams and passing like the National Registry for EMTs. And
paramedics. Oh, yeah, of course.
And I call it a formula and a system. And I try to tell people almost the same type of thing that you're speaking about by telling them that you've got to look at the tactics that you can use, you know, to be successful, and that it's not one size fits all, right? It's a system approach. And I try to show them a system that they can use and one that works for them and one that works for each question and each answer and stuff like that. But I think what ends up happening is, and it's the same type of thing, right? I try to tell them you can get a lot more accomplished in 30 minutes, you know, studying and applying what you're learning with when you're studying than trying to memorize something or trying to use a shortcut like an app or something like that, where, like you said, they can go to the store, right, and get the lock cut, the bolt cutter, or they can just take the time to do it. So it ends up being that people don't see the benefit of almost of time, you know. It's easier, I guess, to go get that bolt cutter, just as it's easier to go just use an app versus using some sort of a system, you know, an approach that you can use that might take a little more effort, but in the end saves you that time, you know? And I try to tell people that all the time. And it's such a hard message to get to people, to get them to see the differences, you know? Someone said, I'll just, like you said, I'll just wait in my car till the morning and then not have to sit there and guess numbers for 2 hours, you know, but yet they can just spend the 2 hours and then they'll be where they want to be rather than trying to sit in their car and sleep for, you know, 8 hours.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that ends up, I guess, being the struggle. But I think, like with anything else, I'm sure people that take your course see that benefit once they do. Just like people that take my course, they see the benefit once they do. It's getting them there, you know. So I hope that people listening, if they're even just mildly interested, will go and get your book and read about this stuff and see that. And I mean, hopefully that will motivate them to maybe get a class going with you. Now, do you travel with the class, or is it one specific place, or how does that work? In case someone's listening and interested in getting that, having that happen for their fire department or their agency, law enforcement agency or something.
Sure. For now, I still have a job in the private sector where I work in the security field, and I enjoy my work. So 40 hours a week, I'm still busy. But on the side, I'm absolutely willing to travel. Right now I can fit about 2, maybe 3 courses a year into my schedule. But if you want to get involved, the first thing to do is go over to my website and click on courses. I do have a few seats left in my next upcoming course. It still is open enrollment. We prefer that you're a first responder or former first responder, just because of the setting of the facility.
Yeah.
So I have a few seats left for this next course in October. Otherwise, you can host a course. If you put together the people, I can work with you on a location and a venue and a setting and all that and the number of students. So probably the easiest way to get in-person training with me is to either host a course or to travel over to the Tampa, Florida area where I'm at. That's much easier for me because then I don't have to worry about travel or hotel or
right,
rental car or any of that stuff.
And is there a limit on what's like the average class do you usually shoot for at the student-wise?
I'm happy with what I do. Again, I do it because it's my passion. I don't like teaching like a conference room full of people, like a what do you call it, like a ballroom or a, okay. what do you say? So my courses are, they have to be, I shoot for 10 or less. I can do 12 or less. But really I'm looking for just kind of that squad size training where 8 people, 9 people, something like that. It really, because some of the techniques are so, intimate, not like in a romantic sense, but intimate, like it's really fine motor skill. It's really up close. It's a small tool. It's a small lock. And because I don't use PowerPoint or overhead video a lot, it really helps to have a small, like a circle of dudes, you know, yeah. guys or gals sitting there on the floor, Indian style, kind of passing locks back and forth in a really small setting.
Which is good. I mean, I think that really, I think translates well to, you know, teaching a firehouse or, you know, law enforcement stuff. And I think that, you know, cause I think they'll get more benefit out of that than sitting at some big conference, you know, continuing education thing and sitting there and, like you said, looking at a PowerPoint deck and not actually putting their hands on anything. So listen, I hope people listening will definitely take you up on that. I want to end it there. I don't want to go on too long about it, but sure. I do want to encourage people to go check out the book, check out the website. I will put links to those in the show notes for people to just, they can go check that out. And like I said, I think even if some agency supervisor or director or something listen to, just get the book and at least have the book, you know, pass it around the squad and let them look at it, and maybe hopefully it'll drive enough interest to actually have them take a physical course, you know, to really put the book and the hand stuff together, you know. So before we end, is there anything you want to mention or kind of drive home before we round it out?
No, I thought this was fantastic. And I think we almost said it earlier or alluded to it similarly, but I'll close with this point. The return on investment is something I really focused on. Again, this is a passion of mine. So it's really important for me that every single student that sits down, as soon as they sit down on the course, they have tools, they have printouts, they have thumb drives with info. I try and give them back all of the value that they gave me in tuition. I try and give that all back to them as soon as the course starts, let alone after the course is over, all the return on investment you get the rest of your life, whether there's a fire or a dead body or a dying person or a shootout on the other side of a lock, or whether it just saves you time and convenience helping a loved one get back into their vehicle or their home. So that return on investment is really a big deal for me. And I do this because I love it. And I do it because I want to bring value to my students.
Yeah. It's a good point. And listen, just when you talk about loved one and stuff, there's been times where I've locked myself out of my vehicle. My wife at the time, she had locked herself out of her vehicle when she was in out in the heat with my daughter, who was a baby at the time. And you feel helpless in those situations, you know, and having this skill can really help you even on a personal level. So I encourage people to go check that out. Again, the website, you can put it in the show notes, but it's uncensoredtactical.com. Go check it out, guys. I think you will benefit. Just go watch the video he has there under his courses tab. I think you'll just like watching the video. It's pretty cool. So, all right, Pat, again, I appreciate you joining me. I hope the listeners got some value out of this. Guys, if you have questions, comments, you can send them over to me as contact@emsofficehours.com. Be sure to check out emsofficehours.com for the previous podcasts and, of course, the Monday Minutes. And as always, guys, I'm Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.